True threats are a form of speech unprotected by the First Amendment. The North Carolina statute that makes communicating threats a misdemeanor, General Statute 14-277.1, includes both the subjective and objective components of a true threat, ensuring a defendant is not convicted for protected speech. The Court of Appeals has now held the trial court erred by revoking a defendant's probation for committing a new criminal offense when the evidence at the violation hearing was insufficient to show that the defendant had made a true threat. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Creed, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina. John, where is the line between recalcitrance and incompetence? That's really the issue in the first case we've got on for today. Tell us about State v. Chafin.
Joe, State v. Chafin is a case we got from the Court of Appeals on September 17th of this year. It's a case out of Mecklenburg County. The underlying facts of the case are not really all that critical to understanding the issues that are being raised on appeal, but they do sort of set the stage for, as you said, this competence or capacity issue. So briefly, the facts are that the defendant was arrested back on May 12th of 2023 at the Novant Presbyterian Hospital by Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department. It all arose out of a series of 911 calls that come in from the hospital. The first call is actually from the defendant around 11 p.m., and he's arguing to the officers who respond to the call that he didn't want to be at this hospital. He wanted to go to a different one, and they weren't taking care of him. And the officers tell him that he's not going to get what he's looking for, and he's yelling and cursing and being uncooperative. But they tell him they're not going to transport him, and so they clear the scene. There's another call that comes in at 12:49 a.m., so early the next morning. Second call from the hospital's location reporting that there's been an accident at the hospital, but it is once again the defendant claiming that he's been hit by a car and that refusing to take care of him at the hospital, but he has not, in fact, actually been struck by a vehicle. So they leave again. There's another call that comes in around 3 a.m., a third 911 call coming from the hospital. Officers respond. Now it's the hospital asking for the defendant to be removed. He's refusing to leave the premises. He's been trespassed. Upon learning that he's been banned from the hospital, the officers say they gave him an opportunity to stand up and leave. He refused to do that, so they put him under arrest for trespassing. He's fighting the officers as they're trying to arrest him, as they say, locking his body and legs and resisting being put in the car. And then as part of all of that, eventually kicks out and strikes one of the officers in the head twice. And so that's what he's charged with in the case. So they get an arrest warrant for assault on a government official or employee, resist, delay, and obstruct, trespassing, misusing 911. There's a district court trial on those misdemeanors, December 6th of 2023. He's convicted of two of them, assault on an officer and resist, delay, and obstruct a public officer. He appeals that to the Superior Court for a trial de novo. The state dismisses the RDO charge, the misuse of 911 and second-degree trespass. They're only proceeding against defendant for this assault on a government official. But before that trial can begin, the defendant is expressing frustration with his court-appointed attorney and is moving the trial judge to appoint substitute counsel. And is basically just saying, in his words, he is filing for insufficient counsel. I do not want her to represent me. I don't think it would be in my best interest. And so the trial judge has some conversations with the defendant about that, noting that they have been conversing, that they have talked a few times. And on other occasions when his attorney has tried to talk with him, he's the one refusing to work with her. Basically, the defendant is saying that she is not looking out for me. I don't want her to be my attorney. But the trial judge ultimately concluded there is good cause to continue this case with the current representation of the defendant. And in the Court of Appeals notes, highlighting the fact that the court-appointed attorney had more than 40 years of experience as an attorney. After that, the defendant then refuses to participate in the trial and is taken into custody under a secured bond. And despite being invited or encouraged to come back into the courtroom, his presence is requested several times to no avail, and he just says no and will not come back out. So the trial court then concludes that he has voluntarily waived his right to be present at trial, and the state proceeds with its first witness. So the defendant is ultimately convicted and then gives notice of his appeal. So there's three issues that we're looking at on appeal. The first one of these is, they call it a competency hearing. My understanding, competency really would just be about a witness is competent or not to testify. This would really be capacity to assist in his defense. But competency or capacity, well, what they're arguing is that the trial court erred by not engaging in a sua sponte in ordering a capacity evaluation to find out whether he really was competent to stand trial. The defendant is arguing there was a bona fide doubt as to whether or not he could do that. And they point to a few things in the record that they argue support that, like his statements about how he is homeless, and they note there's a correlation between homelessness and mental illness, and other times when he arrived late to court and made statements like, quote, he did not care what happened to him, or, you know, did not want to be represented by this attorney, coupled with this sort of irrational or bizarre behavior, all of that that happened on the night in question. And so they're arguing that, you know, I mean, as a matter of due process, and then, of course, under our statutes, under 15A, 1001A, there is this statutory competency requirement. And even if it's not raised by defense counsel or raised by the defendant, the trial court does have this obligation to inquire sua sponte if there is substantial evidence before the court indicating that the accused may be mentally incompetent. But the Court of Appeals, reviewing the trial judge's decision, says there was insufficient evidence in this case to have warranted the initiation of a competency hearing by the trial court. For example, they go through some of these things that the defense argues. Yes, he did arrive late to court, you know, but at the same token, he immediately apologized and provided an explanation for it. And you know, that statement about how he did not want to participate in the trial, or I don't care what's going to happen to me, you know, all of that is within the context of this larger, coherent, cohesive discussion he's having with the judge about how the reasons why he wants a different attorney and the why he's not going to participate in the trial. The defendant, in their words, even the defendant noted that he was able-bodied and his mind was sound. So, in other words, there was really nothing here indicating, you know, Joe, your question in the introduction. I mean, where is that line between somebody who's just recalcitrant, stubborn, disruptive, and somebody who actually lacks capacity to stand trial? And they don't see anything in this case that would have raised that bona fide question for the trial court about whether he really did have that capacity. They go through a few other examples. I think at one point in the sentencing hearing, for example, he volunteers some information about one of his prior convictions. And, you know, again, they might say that's, you know, maybe that's unwise, or that's something that somebody who's unfamiliar or lacks knowledge of the legal process might do something like that. But that doesn't indicate that he fundamentally doesn't understand what's happening in court, or is that he lacks the capacity to assist in his own defense, even if he may just be declining to do that. So there's sort of a wrap-up comment from the Court of Appeals. The evidence detailed above showcases defendant was capable of interacting with his court-appointed attorney at times, conferred with his court-appointed attorney on legal issues, including jury selection, sometimes accepted his court-appointed attorney's advice, understood the nature of the proceedings against him, understood his rights as they relate to appointed and substitute counsel, and calmly and rationally explained why he was upset with his court-appointed attorney when the trial court disagreed. So, yes, there may be a few outbursts, there may be some disruptions, but that was not the kind of thing that would raise a bona fide doubt for the trial judge about whether this defendant lacked capacity. And Joe, that's why I agreed with you when we were talking about cases for the podcast. This is a good one, I think, for prosecutors to look at, because I know they deal with these kinds of defendants all the time in district court or superior court. And so this is a good one to know, because it's concerning to think we might get reversed on appeal that we didn't do this capacity hearing. But I don't want to ask for that unnecessarily and then delay the case potentially for months as we try to wait for an evaluation to get done and a report. So I think this is a good one to reference when you have that person who they might be difficult, they might be unusual, they might have outbursts or irrational behavior, but that isn't necessarily the same thing as raising a bona fide issue for the court that would warrant a sua sponte hearing. The second of the three issues that are raised is about this right to be present. And this is a fairly easy one, I think, for the court to deal with. Yes, of course, a person has a due process right to be present at their trial, constitutional right for all stages of the trial, but that is a right that can be waived. And even in North Carolina, for anything but a capital offense, the trial can proceed in the defendant's absence if they decide they want to waive the right to be present. But there does need to be clear evidence that they are giving up that right. They quote from some prior case law, a case called Sides, in order to waive the right to be present, there must be an intentional relinquishment or abandonment of that right. Now, in this case, we pretty much have that. I mean, it's not something like a clear back and forth colloquy necessarily with the judge, but they point out the defendant voluntarily waived when he left the courtroom and refused to return. And there's these clear statements from that are being made by him. Some of that got discussed during the competency or capacity discussion about do whatever you want. I don't care. There's a trial. They have a quote here from the defendant, what he stated to the trial court. I'm not going forward. I believe y'all can have a trial and handle it. I'm not going to do it. I'm leaving, so do with it what you will. I'm leaving. And then despite that, the trial court made several efforts to try to get the defendant to come back to the courtroom, and he would not do that. So they say that is a pretty good example of somebody who is waiving their right to be present, and they find no error.
Well, let me ask you, Jonathan, about there are certain times when a defendant is going to waive a constitutional right, such as the right to counsel or other issues here, where there are statutes or constitutional requirements that the trial court conduct some kind of inquiry. I take it to waive the right to be present, this is not something that has to be attended by these other formalities. I mean, there doesn't have to be some colloquy, some conversation with the defendant in open court to see if he's actually going to remain there.
Joe, I would say I think we have to have some flexibility here for defendants like this. I mean, this is a defendant who has taken himself back to the holding cell and is essentially refusing to come out. The judge does at one point send the sheriff in there to talk to him, you know, just to make sure he knows he has a right to be present. And we would like for him to be present in the courtroom. And the sheriff comes back and reports, Your Honor, he's refusing to come out. He says he doesn't want to have anything to do with anything that's happening in here. So I think the case law says there does have to be this intentional relinquishment or abandonment of that right. So whatever we're basing it on, let's make sure that's clear in the record and that we've got a solid basis for it. But
we don't have to have a written waiver.
Exactly. And I think there's inevitably going to be circumstances where getting something like that would just be flat out impossible. But here, he's voluntarily choosing to leave. The judge is asking him to come back. He's persisting and refusing to participate, making these statements like, do whatever you want. I don't care. I'm not participating in any of this. They felt like that was clearly sufficient to show that he had voluntarily relinquished his right to be present. The third and final issue that we'll just discuss briefly was arguing about substitute counsel. On appeal, the defendant is arguing that the trial court also erred by not honoring his request to get an alternative counsel. And this, I think they resolve by citing the case law, has pretty clearly established over the years, yes, you have a right to counsel. You have a right to competent and effective counsel. That's not the same thing as the right to counsel of your choosing. You know, there may be an attorney, maybe he didn't like some of their interactions or didn't like some of the decisions that were being made. But as I mentioned earlier, the trial court made inquiries into the defense attorney's years of experience, for example. This is somebody who knew what was going on, was perfectly capable of representing the defendant. And there were even some occasions where they did interact and cooperate without great difficulty. You know, they were picking a juror, for example, they were able to do some of those things. So they felt like in this case, the nature of the conflict between the defendant and counsel was not such as would render counsel ineffective to represent him. If they are totally at loggerheads, you know, fist fighting at counsel table, I mean, then, you know, that may be a different situation. But this was just sort of general disagreement and dissatisfaction with an otherwise competent and capable defense attorney who on occasion the defendant was working with and interacting with. So that was, as they say, a mere disagreement between the defendant and his court-appointed counsel as to trial tactics is not sufficient to require the trial court to replace court-appointed counsel with another attorney. So addressing the third and final of those issues, they find no error, so that conviction is affirmed.
Thank you, John. The second case we've got on for today, also from September 17th of 2025 at the Court of Appeals, this was a case called State v. Thomas. This is a case out of Surrey County. The facts show that back in April of 2020, defendant's home in Mount Airy was accessible only by a dirt driveway, a gravel road easement on the property of his neighbor, Bert Wallace. On the evening of April 9th, 2020, defendant was driving up and down the easement on a four-wheeler when Wallace came out of his garage and began videotaping him. Wallace's wife, Danielle, apparently started a physical confrontation with defendant's wife and stepmother. There is some evidence that defendant's stepmother was injured in that altercation. Defendant got off the four-wheeler, saw Wallace coming up the driveway at him. Defendant claimed he thought Wallace was reaching for a gun, and the defendant shot Wallace twice. In May of 2020, defendant was charged with assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury. The matter came on for trial by jury in February of 2024. At the defendant's request, the jury was instructed on self-defense, defense of another, and over the objection of the state, defense of habitation. There was conflicting evidence as to where this shooting actually took place, whether defendant was still on his property or was on Wallace's property at the time this happened. Defendant was convicted by a jury of assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, inflicting serious injury, and he appealed. On appeal, defendant argued that the trial court erred in its instructions on self-defense and defense of habitation. The state made the argument that defendant had requested these instructions, and in other cases where the defendant is the beneficiary of his own request, he generally is not permitted to argue on appeal that whatever he got was erroneous. The Court of Appeals noted, however, that in between the time that the parties and the trial court had heard this case in front of the jury, that the North Carolina Supreme Court decided a case called State v. Phillips that kind of changed the rules, clarified what the rules are for defense of habitation under our new statutes, and the Court of Appeals elected to review this issue for plain error because, as it explained, the parties did not have the benefit of Phillips at the time of trial. Under General Statute 14-51.2, and this statute has been around since about 2011, a lawful occupant of a home, including the curtilage, is presumed to have a reasonable fear of death or serious bodily harm when using deadly force if, one, the victim was unlawfully and forcefully entering, and two, the defendant knew or had reasonable grounds to believe it. But under the statute, this presumption is rebuttable and does not apply in five listed circumstances. In State v. Phillips, that was that 2024 case, the North Carolina Supreme Court held that the presumption may be rebutted only by the circumstances listed in the statute. It also held, and this was the second major holding in Phillips, there is no excessive force restriction on the lawful use of force in defense of habitation. The particular error in Phillips was that the trial court said, and apparently at odds with the statutory language, that a defendant in the lawful defense of his home or motor vehicle is still not permitted to use excessive force. Phillips held that in the context of defense of home under 14-51.2, excessive force is a legal impossibility. There is no excessive force restriction on the lawful use of deadly force in defense of habitation. In this case, Thomas, the trial court instructed the jury that absent evidence to the contrary, the lawful occupant of a home is presumed to have a reasonable fear when using deadly force if the victim was unlawfully and forcefully entering and the defendant knew it. The trial court instructed the jury that the presumption of reasonable fear could be rebutted by the state's evidence. The trial court also instructed the jury on the excessive force restriction to the use of force in self-defense, without, however, clarifying that that excessive force restriction would not apply in the context of defense of habitation. The Court of Appeals found that these instructions were misleading because they did not clarify that the instruction on excessive force would not apply to defense of habitation. The Court of Appeals noted in that regard that the prosecutor argued in closing that a person is never permitted to use excessive force either in self-defense or defense of habitation. At the time the prosecutor made that argument, it was not, at least arguably, it was not wrong. Phillips had not come down to say that there's no restriction on excessive force in defense of home. So there's no indication in this Court of Appeals opinion, Thomas, that the prosecutor made an improper argument, but the Court of Appeals used that as kind of a buttressing fact that these jury instructions were misleading under Thomas. The Court of Appeals also agreed with defendant that the instruction as given, that is including that phrase, absent evidence to the contrary, that that instruction allowed the jury to consider evidence beyond the prescribed circumstances to rebut the statutory presumption. It said, quote, in the context of this case, the jury could believe that evidence to the contrary would be evidence that the defendant used excessive force, but this is not a proper consideration under the defense of habitation. Noting that the defense of home instructions here did not contain the excessive force restriction found erroneous in Phillips, the Court of Appeals nevertheless found, quote, no practical difference between Phillips and this case. So it ultimately concluded that these instructions were erroneous just as they were in Phillips. And then turning to whether the error in the instruction was prejudicial, the Court of Appeals said that the error did have a probable impact on the outcome. It noted that there was conflicting evidence as to whether Wallace forcibly entered defendant's property and the jury was not properly instructed on the statutory presumption that might have justified defendant's conduct. In conclusion, the Court of Appeals held that the trial court erred by one, failing to address the limited circumstances that may rebut the presumption of reasonable fear, and two, by failing to limit the excessive force restriction to self-defense where the jury might have misunderstood that it applied also to defense of habitation. The Court of Appeals found that the error rose to the level of plain error, and this warranted a new trial.
So, Joe, if the pattern jury instructions have not yet been updated, is this case telling prosecutors that if we've got a situation where the jury is going to be instructed on self-defense and also defense of habitation, we need to make sure that a sentence has been inserted in there to clarify, in case you were maybe going to incorrectly apply this to the other defense, don't do that?
That would seem to be a reasonable reading of this case, yes, because the Court of Appeals rejected the state's argument here that the trial court was just following the pattern instructions. And the pattern instructions, I might add, that the defendant specifically requested in this case, the Court of Appeals found those instructions were misleading because there was no clear delineation between the self-defense instruction for which a defendant is not permitted to use excessive force and the defense of home instruction where under Phillips, there is no excessive force restriction. So I think you're right. I think until we get a revision of those pattern instructions, it would be a good idea in a case where both defenses are at play for the trial court to make very explicit, as suggested by Thomas, that the excessive force restriction applies only to self-defense, defense of others, not to those defensive habitation elements.
Joe, I'm just playing devil's advocate. I mean, don't we normally presume that jurors follow the instructions, right? And so if they've got defense A over here and we say, this is how you resolve defense A, and then defense B over here, and this is how you resolve defense B, isn't there an argument to be made that we should assume that they would just process A correctly and process B correctly and presume that they would not misapply something from A to B? Or the Court of Appeals is saying the risk is too great, viewed as a whole, the way it's presented.
The Court of Appeals recited the rule that jury instructions will be construed in their entirety. So, John, I think you're absolutely right. I think we tend to believe that juries are going to follow the instructions that they're given. And I think absent evidence of some misunderstanding, it's reasonable to assume that they can distinguish one instruction from the other. But here, the Court of Appeals found that where these instructions were sort of back to back adjoining one another, and where the instruction repeatedly told the jury that excessive force was not permitted in self-defense, there was some possibility that the jury might have misunderstood that also to apply in the defense of habitation
right.
context.
Okay, so we presume they follow and do what they're told, but if what they're told is potentially misleading or confusing, then they may still end up with the wrong result.
I think that's one way to reconcile it. Honestly, I think this is a difficult opinion, and I think the takeaway could be precisely what you said earlier. It would certainly be advisable to insert an additional instruction in the defensive force context to say, look, that excessive force restriction that you might have heard about for self-defense does not apply here.
That's a little odd. I mean, that's sort of a proactive instruction we don't seem to have to give in other circumstances, but I guess until we hear differently, that's all we can do.
That's right. Last case we've got on for today, I think, is Stafey Creed.
We'll talk about what this case did say and how it was resolved. And then you and I have talked about it a little. I think there's a sort of an alternative way that it could have come out, but did not, might be relevant in other circumstances for prosecutors dealing with things other than a probation violation hearing. But what we're talking about in State versus Creed is a Court of Appeals case we got on September 17th, a case out of Surrey County. The defendant in this case had previously pled guilty back in January of 2024 to possession of firearm by a felon and a misdemeanor possession of marijuana, was placed on 36 months of supervised probation for that. His probation officer filed a violation report in March and July of 2024 alleging various violations, but one of those being that he had violated the condition about committing no new criminal offense, and the substance of that violation was that he had made credible threats concerning Judge Puckett, a Superior Court judge, and Detective Johnson of the Surrey County Sheriff's Office. So that's the violation that we are then having a hearing about in August of 2024. At that hearing, the state proceeded only on this violation for the alleged threat that was made against the Detective Johnson. And at the hearing, the state presents testimony from three witnesses, Justin Potts, Detective Johnson, and the defendant's probation officer, Officer Funt. Where this came from was that on June 30th of 2024, the defendant had called this civilian witness Potts on the phone, all stressed out and saying that he was mad enough to kill somebody. And this Potts, who was a friend of the defendant, was mad enough that he went to go visit the defendant while he was in custody. And Potts at the hearing testified later that the defendant didn't say he was going to kill either one of them, but just that he had a lot of animosity towards Brandon, towards Detective Johnson. A couple days later, Potts learned from a family member that the defendant had actually been committed to the hospital for trying to kill himself. With that additional evidence of his mental condition, he was apparently then concerned enough to contact Detective Johnson because he knew that detective and thought highly of him. So he wanted him to know what the defendant had said a couple of days earlier. That was the testimony from Potts at the hearing. The detective at the hearing also testified that he had never met the defendant, never dealt with him, never arrested him, but that he was nevertheless concerned with what the defendant had said. And he then reported it to the district attorney's office. So that was his testimony, or the bulk of his testimony. And then finally, the probation officer testified, basically testifying that the defendant had made these disturbing comments about ending his life, and that was what had led to his involuntary commitment, and that these threats were the basis of this violation that he filed. The defendant is found to be in violation, so his probation was revoked and his sentence was activated, and that's what he's appealing from. He's arguing on appeal that his probation should not have been revoked because the state did not present sufficient evidence that he communicated a threat under 14-277.1 in light of State v. Taylor and the cases that have come subsequent to that, incorporating what has sort of long been established under federal case law, but took a little while to catch up in North Carolina, that you can only criminalize and punish pure speech like a threat if it is a true threat, as those Supreme Court cases and now more of our state cases have interpreted that. And what it means is a true threat, this is coming from that Taylor Supreme Court opinion, a true threat is an objectively threatening statement communicated by a party which possesses the subjective intent to threaten a listener or an identifiable group. The true in that term distinguishes what is at issue from jests, hyperbole, or other statements that when taken in context do not convey a real possibility that violence will follow. And then we assess that sort of as a, on appeal, they look at it as what they call whole record review. But even at the trial court level, we're looking at the whole picture. We look at the context. You know, what was the nature of exactly what was said, the reaction of the listeners? We factor all that in to assess this objective and subjective component. But here they're saying this was not one. The Court of Appeals is saying the evidence that was presented at the revocation hearing did not adequately establish either the objectively threatening statement being made or this subjective intent of threatening the listener. We didn't have that intent on the part of the defendant. He made, in the words of Potts at the hearing, he made a general statement that he was mad enough to kill somebody, and he may have specifically mentioned this detective and this judge, but they're saying he did not threaten a specific person. In their words, quoting from Potts' testimony, defendant didn't say he was going to kill either one of them, but just that he had a lot of animosity towards this officer. So they're saying that is not sufficient to support a finding that these were serious expressions conveying that he meant to commit an act of unlawful violence. And also looking at the reactions that people had, they sort of, you know, again, viewing this in the totality, looking at the context and the nature of exactly what was said, they do not believe this was taken as a serious expression of an intent to kill or injure the detective. For example, when Potts heard it, he didn't feel the need to do anything about it until 2 days later when he learned that the defendant had apparently attempted to take his own life and was then committed for treatment. So, you know, that was further evidence that there wasn't really this objectively threatening statement being made that conveyed this subjective intent to directly threaten the detective. Based on that version of the facts, one would say that is not a true threat. You know, you and I were discussing earlier, I think you had sort of noted, especially in the context of a probation violation hearing, that sort of the appellate court is focusing on certain testimony, but there is some different testimony that comes out at the hearing.
Yeah, Jonathan, didn't the officer testify that Potts say defendant said he was going to kill someone?
Right. So, you know, at the hearing, Potts, I mean, there's the part I mentioned already, the detective referencing the defendant says, never met him, never dealt with him, never arrested him, never been part of any investigation. But yes, he was concerned. But what the detective says at the hearing is that Potts came to him, this friend of the defendant. He says Potts told him that the defendant had made statements about wanting to kill me and kill Judge Puckett. And that was sort of the point that you and I were discussing, Joe. I think you made a really good observation, is that specifically this is a probation violation hearing, right? There's no rules of evidence here. So it's not like...
There's no beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, this is supposed to be evidence sufficient in the trial court's discretion that convinces him that a new criminal offense has occurred. And it looks to me like what happened was there was conflicting evidence at the violation hearing that the trial court resolved by crediting Johnson's testimony that defendant made a threat against somebody's life.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if this were a trial, then hey, the testimony that came in at court from Potts is he said he was angry, he said he was mad at these people, but he never specifically threatened to kill anybody. And then we are, I don't know, sort of partly corroborating and partly impeaching that with the prior statement he made to the detective. But this is a probation violation hearing, right? So we're not really subject to those rules of evidence. I think you're right. It would be entirely within the trial court's purview to say, based on the testimony I've heard, seeing and hearing from these people live and in person right here in court, I could reach the conclusion that what Potts told the detective early on is exactly what was said. Hey, I'm coming to talk to you because I'm concerned. He threatened to kill you, and that makes me scared. And then in court with the defendant sitting right there at the table, this friend of the defendant might be I don't know, pulling back a little on how strongly he wants to word his answers. And so the trial court could have found, I think the credible testimony is, yes, you threatened to kill this officer, and therefore that is a true threat. So it's sort of interesting in that way. I mean, if the evidence is a statement that is only along the lines of, I'm mad at these people, I'm angry at these, or even I'm mad enough to kill, but you know, it's not something as clear, as objective and subjectively threatening as, when I get out of this jail cell, I'm going to go kill this detective, you know, then I would agree it's not a true threat. But it's interesting. There's an argument to be made that the evidence could have supported kind of going the other way. I mean, the trial judge, if we credit the other testimony that, no, he explicitly threatened to kill the detective, then, you know, arguably there would be evidence to support a true threat.
But that's not what the Court of Appeals did.
Not what the Court of Appeals did
here. Looks at Potts's testimony and finds that there wasn't sufficient evidence to show that he had actually made a threat against anybody's life.
And I think that would be our takeaway for the prosecutors, because I know this comes up a lot. Things land on your desk. You're being asked to assess them. Is this a threat? You know, I mean, is it clear and explicit enough? When I get those questions or when I get those cases, what I talk to prosecutors about is it doesn't always have to be just absolutely black and white. The moment I get out of this jail cell, I'm going to this detective's house and I'm going to kill him. I think post-Taylor, these ones that are a little bit murky or a little bit debatable, that is a steeper hill to climb in the wake of State v. Taylor and some other cases, like I guess now we would add the State versus Creed. So, you know, if the statement is murky, then we need to be doing more to make sure we're clear on the surrounding circumstances. You know, if you want to charge this because to you it is clearly a true threat, then let's make sure we're getting everything into evidence we need to explain why, taken in context, looking at the parties, looking at the nature of exactly what was said, the full picture, here's why it's both objectively threatening and it does indicate the subjective intent to threaten on the part of the speaker.
Well, thank you, John. That's all we've got for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. Chafin, finding insufficient evidence to establish a bona fide doubt as to defendant's competence, State v. Thomas, where the trial court erred by failing to limit the restriction on excessive force to self-defense, and State v. Creed, reversing the revocation of probation where the evidence was insufficient to show a true threat. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We are coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu. That's J-H-Y-D-E @sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org. That's jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helped.